Hello and welcome to Politics Weekly.
Tom and I are here today with two hardy perennials of the Guardian Pod, Seamus Milne and Julian Glover.
Now, whatever our differences in this pod, we seek to maintain at all times a cooperative ethos. And this week, we'll be talking about the sudden mayhem for mutualisation.
We're also going to look at the relationship, or otherwise, the Tories are striking with minority groups.
But before we do, Labour MP David Wright has lowered the tone this week by calling the Conservatives scum-sucking pigs. Or at least that's what he appeared to do on a Twitter tweet. Forget the rights and wrongs of it, though. What's your favourite political insult, Seamus?
Now, you should have given me a warning of that. I thought scum-sucking pigs was fair enough. I don't know what all the fuss is about, really.
Echoes of lower than vermin.
Yeah, it's a big tradition in the Labour Party of saying these things going back decades.
But then, Seamus, he tried to say that his computer was stolen and his Twitter account hacked into. So clearly he did think something he shouldn't have said.
Well, that was very New Labour, that he did a bit of a U-turn and he
completely
sort of
undermined the message.
He didn't inhale.
Julian, you got a favourite?
Well, I think you need a bit of humour, and the problem with some scum-sucking pigs, it's not funny. It might alliterate, but nothing else. I don't know, being savaged by a dead sheep with Jeffrey
Nash. Yeah.
Good one.
Things with jokes in.
And animals.
Yeah, British love animals. Well, there was a pig in that one too.
And Australia, where you've just got back from, there's some good ones, aren't there? I think, was it Keating who said this thing, it remains to be seen whether the Australian people will see a souffle rise for the second time.
Well, it's the same Keating who's always supposed to have said that Darwin was the place you looked down on the way to Europe, but he lost all the Northern Territory votes. And no, but Australian politics is really vicious and insults. Yeah, I was there last week, and the shadow finance minister was compared to a backpacker murderer who'd been picking up backpackers in Queensland and slaughtering them by a front-rank Labour politician. And there wasn't even very much outrage about it. It was almost seriously debated whether there was a similarity.
So hold on a second. Why the outrage this week?
The shadow finance minister, Barnaby Joyce, is, I hesitate to say nuts, but an extraordinary individual who speaks his mind. He's a sort of Boris Johnson of the bush. He just absolutely declares the most extraordinary things. He said home insulation, big issue in Australia at the moment. It's the stuff in the roof for rats to urinate on. And gave a speech about that. So he just speaks out.
So
other people
slag him off. Forward-thinking on climate change.
He's very, very forward-thinking on climate change. He knows exactly where he stands. He's sure it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Can I have my favourite? Popinjay. It was Hitch to Galloway, or Galloway to Hitch.
A drink soaked Trotsky-like Popinjay by any chance?
But we've got to have our favourite.
Because it's clean.
It's clean
and accurate.
I swear a lot
in my everyday life, but I think clean and, yeah.
But the insult of the week was surely the Guardian's description of Piers Morgan as a pipsqueak.
Ouch.
Well, from heady feelings to mutual feelings, this week the parties have been fighting over who's most cooperative. On Monday, the Tories announced that if they formed the next government, they'd let public sector workers take over the running of their services. Labour retaliated quickly and said that with them, councils could mutualise all services, whatever that means. Julian, I've heard it suggested that you said the Tory policy owes a lot to Tony Benn, does it?
Well, he was the famous politician who talked about cooperatives and worker ownership of industry in the 1970s, and the Triumph Meriden motorcycle factory was the famous example. I think one of the things that people aren't getting in this whole debate about mutualism, and it is interesting, is they don't get the ownership of assets. And one of the key things in a lot of cooperatives, and in John Lewis, which I know, I was talking to people at John Lewis recently, they get a bit frustrated when they see John Lewis all over the headlines linked to party policy, because it isn't the same, because you have to own the assets. You have to own the means of production and share that out between people. Mm. All of these schemes are largely talking about the means of management. The assets and the cash still belong to somebody else, and that does make it different. It isn't a cooperative where you share the income, share any profits as dividends that go to partners, as it does with John Lewis. So it's not the same as John Lewis. And that perhaps ownership element is really what makes cooperatives work, you know, in all sorts of ways, from big city firms that work like that.
I think that in the Labour case, they are actually talking about, at the end of the day, there being this possibility of dividends going back to the user.
Yes.
Well, council tax discounts, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. The Tory party...
I mean, there is a problem with language, but then there is also a problem with, if you talk... I mean, the Tory party are talking about cooperatives as worker-led, but, Labour would like users to be involved too, and they would at once some stage like them to get something back. So on the one hand, you're talking about a terminology problem. On the other hand, you're talking about a difference in what people want to try and roll out.
Yes, and I think if you have you can have different models of cooperatives. I mean, traditionally, the one has been that you can have customers, see the co-op supermarket can have people who are sort of members and who can get dividends as well, and that can work. But it's perhaps an easy thing, a very fashionable thing, just to say, let's make everything like John Lewis. And everybody knows John Lewis is very nice. It really isn't the same as all sorts of bits of public service. It's not so easy just to badge it as John Lewis, or badge it as EasyJet in a different way, as Barnet Council's been doing. And this hunt for a few corporate labels that sound good to make public services better. I mean, some people have been talking about occasionally about making things like Google as well. Mm. Backing off that a bit now, we've got the Google buzz row, but it's more complex. These things are different.
But Seamus, isn't it well-intentioned? I mean, obviously you don't want to nick a... I mean, it's kind of undermined by people always looking to a consumer model. So you're kind of initially, it's kind of stillborn because it's public services shouldn't necessarily be, or shouldn't at all be based on a consumer model. But at the same time, John Lewis is an amazing... It's an amazing feat of sort of worker corporation, isn't it?
I mean, John Lewis isn't a cooperative. And
yes,
it's actually,
but they
and
it, get
but first thing, and second, it's a very hierarchical organisation. So neither in terms of the way it's owned, nor in terms of the way it's run, does it really reflect the real cooperative traditions, which are, as you said, a big part of labour movement and socialist tradition. So I think it's a very positive thing that the Tory party is feeling it's necessary to sort of nick bits from this tradition. And the fact that Cameron talks a lot about inequality and the fact that he's talking about cooperatives and the fact that he's talking about minority rights, I would say, you know, that's a very positive reflection of the way British society and politics has changed. I mean, there's many bad things that have happened in the last decade, but I think it does show that a part of the political spectrum has moved to the left and the Tories having to respond to that. Now, when it comes to the actual issues themselves, I think it's a very different picture. I mean, I think, in a way... you know, if we were talking in Tony Benn style about bringing cooperatives into the private sector and the truly market sector, that would be a really, truly radical thing.
Also with some of the nationalised banks.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. I think when you're talking about public services, there are many, many pitfalls, and it could just end up, in this case, being another form of privatisation where, you know, paying conditions are reduced for the workforce, where consultants are brought in, where joint ventures bring in private owners as well as managers. So I think, you know, what it would actually add up to in practice is a different thing, but the kind of political mood music, I think, is pretty interesting.
But privatisation, of course, hasn't stopped while all the people, politicians, are talking about this. It was a thing in the paper this morning about Ofsted and a lot of its frontline inspections are going to be sold off.
And a whole hospital in Cambridgeshire is being handed over to completely private management.
So this kind of broader trend is still going on, but they're all talking about mutualism. But
absolutely crucial point that privatisation is going ahead full scale all the time,
but isn't
driven
there,
by private
interests.
Nonetheless,
even if this is partly a cover for privatisation, isn't there something in the idea that people
the
would
two are going on at the same time? I mean, and that's one of the things that I think is slightly frustrating about the government's position, is that they want mutualism to be, or mutual public services to be, part of the rich tapestry of provision in any given area.
And this is a good thing, and privatisation can be a good thing. What both of these intend to do is to break up monolithic structures. That includes monolithic pay and conditions agreements, which are a negative thing, not a positive thing. And you can do it in different ways. It shouldn't just be done by a single model. It certainly shouldn't just be done by three or four pretty awful, heavily debted city companies bidding for contracts, as we've had with PFI. That doesn't work. But breaking things up, having different structures of management, often different structures within the same area of profession. So schools run one way, schools run another way. Some hospitals might be run by private contractors. They shouldn't all be. Some should be run by cooperatives. There isn't a universal model.
Yeah, and that's what... I dissent from it almost every point that Julian just made. I mean, I think...
It's allowed?
I think, in fact, you know, of course, when we're talking about monolithic management, who would be in favour of that? And in fact, within the public sector, they're through unions and managements working together in places like Newcastle, different models of running public services and actually saving money at the same time without attacking pay and conditions have been very successful. I think the privatisation record is uniformly negative in the private sector, overwhelmingly so, and is also increasingly driven by corruption, political and civil service corruption.
Isn't there something in this idea that if you give people ownership of a problem, they'll respond to it more proactively than if you
Absolutely. So that's about involving employees through representative structures and through real decentralisation at the workplace, which should be happening in the public sector and can happen in the public sector.
And one part of the Conservative interest in this model and the Labour one is the recognition that people in the public sector are not always just motivated by profit. That people have often, not always, but often chosen to work in these careers because they feel a sense of commitment. And when they have very, very centralised, top-down, targeted, measured ways of running their lives, they feel that that commitment's spoilt. They're ordered what to do. They're measured in ways they don't really trust. And they don't have much to say over how things are run. So this is at least an attempt to try and look at it differently.
I mean, for all that we're sort of talking as if all the politicians have embraced it and are running with it, there are senior politicians who sort of sigh at it because they've heard it so often and so forcefully put. Decades ago. Not with Ben, but as you were saying earlier, Tom, you know, Jack Straw in 94 or whatever.
The argument for getting rid of Clause 4 was we'll have more mutualism. Then it turned out it didn't happen. So I just instinctively look at these things with, it sounds nice, I think there's something in it, but whether Whitehall will really drive it through or not, I'm not sure.
The other problem is that thick of it, when the minister gets up and says, the fourth sector, I've got this great idea, the fourth sector, and what's going to happen is you're going to provide your services. And it's kind of similar.
Well, the best satire is spot on.
For more on all of this, head to the politics site, and if I get my way, we're going to have an entire mutual special page.
Lucky Allegra. Well, there's no shortage of speculation about David Cameron running a minority government, but will he also be able to run a government for the minorities? This week, top Tory Nick Herbert has been over to America to talk about the role of gay people in conservative politics. We asked Derek Munn of the gay rights charity Stonewall to give us his take on what Mr. Herbert had to say.
When Nick Herbert said in his Washington lecture that many gay people share conservative values, that's self-evidently the case. There are 3.6 million lesbian and gay people in Britain, and they come from right across the political spectrum. Now, Nick himself would recognise that some of the positions taken by the Conservative Party in the past have made some gay voters reluctant to support them. David Cameron's apology for Section 28 was historic. There's no doubt about that. And as we look forward, David Cameron has recently made strong statements on homophobic bullying, which Stonewall welcome. He's made very clear, whatever one's view of tax breaks for marriage, he's made clear repeatedly that any such breaks would apply equally to civil partners. That's also very welcome. So in terms of the forward agenda, no, these are welcome signs. Now, looking backwards, clearly, not only Section 28, but there have been other votes where Conservative members have taken a different view to Stonewall. And we have to say that even more recently, particularly in the House of Lords, some Conservative members, albeit on a free vote, have spoken and voted in ways which certainly didn't meet with Stonewall's approval.
Julian, Cameron voted against the repeal of Section 28 not many years ago, I think just before he became leader, and then, as Derek Munn says, he apologised. What changed?
Society changed. The Conservative Party changed.
In a couple of years?
In 4 or 5 years. The days, it's quite a recent development in British politics that you could be openly gay. As Nick Herbert and Sullivan were saying in their speech in America, there are no openly gay congressmen from either party. British politics is unusual in the number of people who now feel confident about discussing their sexuality. Of course, there have always been gay and lesbian MPs, but they haven't always been able to admit it in all parties. Labour led, and one of the great things that Labour will have done when it, if it loses the election, will be able to look back and say we have a really strong record, not just of passing legislation and changing some of the most overt discrimination, because discrimination does remain, but doing it in a way that felt nationally collective, that it wasn't a controversial issue. The Conservative Party did, in the end, back civil partnerships. It was probably the best speech Alan Duncan will ever make in the House of Commons, was persuading and leading his party on that. It was a really moving speech. Mm. So the Conservative Party didn't oppose that one, but Labour led it. And it's hard to think that the pace would have been the same if Labour hadn't been in power. So the Conservative Party has been slow to catch up, but it has been catching up. And I do think the change is genuine.
He had to vote the way he did in, was it 2004, 2005? I can't remember when it was.
I can't remember the exact date. Cameron's voting record is a bit patchy. He's also voted, you know, he voted in favour of gay adoption and was hugely attacked by the Catholic Church for that. So he's had some votes where he has stood up and voted what I would say is the right way. Mm. But I think maybe that point that was made at the start in that interview is the key one, which is people sometimes think that your sexuality should derive how you vote. So you judge the kind of market offers of different parties, and clearly that's part of it, because if a party is offering extreme discrimination, you'd be a fool to vote for it. But political identity is not directly connected to sexuality. People have all sorts of political attitudes, who are gay, who are straight, who are lesbian. Mm. And so what the Conservative Party has, I think, genuinely done is made itself a party where gay people can feel at home. And openly at home. And if it wins the election, it will have more openly gay and lesbian MPs than the Labour Party will. And that is a genuine shift in attitude.
It, Isn't
do you buy Julian's argument?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously true. I mean, it's really a European phenomenon rather than just a British phenomenon, I think. I mean, it's interesting the difference between
this
Europe
consensus.
And America,
come on, Tom, break it up.
I don't think I can accept it because Derek Munn joined us from Stonewall there at the beginning, kind of gave this idea that there is a consensus. But David Cameron voted against giving lesbian people the same rights to IVF as heterosexual people as recently as 2008.
About
30% of the shadow cabinet has some aspects of its record are not positive. They're not
but
all
that is a
heavily
positive
negative
vote for but, discrimination.
Yes, he also voted positively in other ways against discrimination.
I mean, the point is that the Tories have been catching up. Obviously, Labour has set the pace on this and has always been more progressive on the issue, and the Lib Dems as well. And the Tory leadership has understood that it's no longer politically advantageous to occupy that space. And David Cameron is a political opportunist in both the good and the bad senses of that. And he's adjusted accordingly. And it's obviously welcome that the Tory leadership and some parts of the Tory party are catching up with society and what Labour and the Lib Dems have done. I mean, I would say that's more on the sexuality issue than on other aspects of minority issues, which have been very divisive and centres of discrimination.
Can we just turn
British society in the past
to some of those other minorities now? Just because Boris Johnson, we learnt yesterday, is going to abolish funding for Jewish Day and is going to take funding away from Black History Month and from Africa Day. Fair enough, you might think this is just cuts, but at the same time, he's going to boost funding for St. George's Day and USA Day, bizarrely. What are we to make of this? How does this fit in with the minority politics?
Well, as you say correctly, it's silly on the latter part. He shouldn't be boosting funding. There's actually no reason why taxpayers of London should have to fund Black History Month, but it is something that people will question if the money is diverted elsewhere rather than saved, as it should be.
And what do you think? And so you were saying, Seamus, that you think there's been more progress in the Tory party on the issue of gay representation than maybe some of the other minorities. Do you think this is a significant move?
Well, I mean, Boris's position is positioned to the right of the Tory leadership, isn't it? So, I mean, he's the kind of outrider on this kind of stuff. And this is a kind of dog whistle politics. I mean, of course, it's positive that, the mayor's office was funding, attempts to overcome ingrained discrimination and disadvantage in society. That's a positive thing. And getting rid of it is a negative thing. Boris is really doing is trying to appeal to voters who might be attracted towards the BNP and UKIP to try and say to them, actually, we're on your side. I mean, of course, the USA. What's the organisation called? The USA Day or the
USA Day.
I mean, that is the irony of it, isn't it? I mean, it's not just promoting English nationalism, but American nationalism, as though Britain's already subsumed itself into the United States.
So, the thing I find fascinating here is that if you listen to Johnson talking about ancient history, and he did some very, very good programmes on TV. He makes the point always that he's part Turkish himself. He's actually a really sophisticated thinker, I think, about issues of multiculturalism when he's talking about them away from the political debate. But it does seem like this is a bit of a low
card. I'm not sure
I'd agree with you about that. I mean, if you look at his record over a number of years, I would say he's pretty crude.
But also, his advisor, Munira Mirza, is sort of, she's kind of cornered the market when she was an academic in the end of the race industry. She hates it.
Yes.
And she did. And I think that she wanted to do this from hour one.
I'm sure they
she?
Did. If you elect a Conservative mayor of London, he will do Conservative things. And that I don't think there's any sort of God-given law that says there has to be state funding of certain campaigns. But it is difficult for the Conservative Party on these things, because there is much pressure, as you say, Seamus, for them to show slightly right-wing tendencies, not overt discrimination, but little bits that just encourage people to think they aren't too much on the PC brigade. But just on the gay rights stuff, which is what we're talking about this week, I mean, Nick Clegg, the Lib Dems, are also trying to push on this, and he did an interview this week saying, no, we're the party of rights. But I don't think it is a thing that the Conservatives are doing to win votes. It is a little bit of looking modern and metropolitan. But I'm not sure that having Nick Herbert go to America and make a speech, partly praising the Labour Party on its record as well, as he did, quite rightly, is something that will make lots of Conservatives feel, oh good, I'll vote for David Cameron. It is also part of a genuine shift in conservative thinking?
Well, I think it appeals to the kind of people who are maybe, you know, quite free market or right wing in economic and social policy, but are progressive on liberal policy and liberal on social policy.
But it
and it's saying to them, you can be safe voting Tory.
I don't think it's just about appealing. I think that is where the party has moved to.
The party leadership.
I think it's a genuine.
The benign side effect for them is that they it's appealing to the liberal voter.
It will appeal to quite a lot of liberal voters. It will also push off a lot of people in the right of the party who think, oh, God, David Cameron, what on earth
are
you doing?
Where are they going to vote?
Well, as you said, you know, are they going off to UKIP?
Yeah.
Well, let's wind that up here. Head to the website for more on this and just about everything else.
That is it for this week. Thanks to Julian Glover and Seamus Milne for coming into the studio.
And thanks also to the award-winning Francesca Panetta for producing.
Till next week.
Goodbye.